It's time for the Access of Easy podcast, the weekly technology digest that keeps you ahead of the curve. Brought to you by EasyDNS.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Axis of Easy. This is number 348. My name is Joey. That's Len. Buddy, I haven't seen you on camera in a week due to a number of circumstances we don't have to talk about tonight. But I will say that I just finished 2 hours recording with BTC Sessions, Why Are We Bullish? I am raring to go here for another 30 or 35 minutes on the latest and greatest in data breach and overreach. And even though we had our differences in the last week, I'm still happy to see you. How the heck are you?
It's nothing personal, though. It's always just business. Oh, I'm good, Joey. Yeah, you know what? We had a small chat before we went live just for, you know, what's going on. And not once did we talk about what happened a couple of days ago.
There's no need.
Hey, man, you know, it's all good. But yeah, no, it was great. You know what? It's nice and warm. Yeah. I got to sit on my porch, do some work today. It's now finally the summer of Len is coming to fruition, and it's going to be a good summer. I cannot wait for it to get even warmer. How are you, Joey?
I'm great, man. I had a fence built today. My dog Moose has been familiarizing himself with the neighbor's yards over the last 8 months. You know, he turned 9 months today, actually. When the fence was finished, I let him out in the backyard, and my neighbors came out and were saying about, oh, we're going to miss him coming over. You know, my contractor said the neighbors came out and told him to leave a little slot for Moose to come over and visit. Turns out he doesn't need it, Len. He has been hiding from me over the last few months that he has a spot in the chain link fence between one of my neighbors and my backyard. As soon as the fence went up, he just tore to the side of the house into the bushes. And before I knew it, the next time I saw him, he was on my neighbor's backyard property again. So I got to figure out what to do about this now. The guy's very, very clever and very popular. Exactly. Right. So, you know, it's okay. Good dog. He's okay by me, and the fence looks good. You're right, though. Weather was beautiful today. A lot of people out walking their dogs, a lot of shorts and t-shirts. You'd love to see it. Canadian winters are always so long. Or they feel long, even if they're only, you know, really, 6 months of really, you know, tough to deal with weather outside. It's not that bad. Not as good as other places in the world, obviously. But the Canadian winters get a bad rap from our American friends, I think, a lot of the time, even though it's really not quite as bad as they say.
It's way too long for me. One day of cold is too long. You know, it's true. It's only like really 4 or 5 months of just, you know, potentially
and how much really of snow, right? Like you might get 3 months this year, especially. Did you even shovel this year? I think we talked about this before. I didn't shovel a single time.
Nah, I proudly said I left my shovel in the garage, didn't even see the light of day. Yeah. Maybe next year or this next coming winter. But yeah. But you know what? It's an anomaly.
Who has better conditions as far as like you know, the conditions that a prisoner might expect? Someone who's stuck in Abu Ghraib or your shovel? Who sees more light during their sentence?
Not my shovel. You know what? Like, and you know what? I'll explain why, because I tend to do the shoveling when it's dark, so it really doesn't see much light at all. Yeah, when I shovel the snow, it's usually like at the end of the day. Sun went down.
Yeah, 4 or 5 o'clock. Sure. Yeah, fair enough. In my head, I'm thinking dark, 8 o'clock. It's going to be cold. The snow's harder to shovel, but you're right. Yeah, 4 or 5 o'clock.
No, to me, that's the best time to do it. It's quiet. There's nobody around. It's very peaceful. Aside from being cold and snowy, it's actually quite pleasant. I mean, but I'd rather be anywhere else in the world at that time because I hate the snow. But you know what? Actually, let me just rephrase that. There's a lot worse places you could be off than in Canada, even though sometimes we're, you know, negative, but man, oh man, let's be honest, there's a lot of crappy places out there, and Canada's not on that list. So
yeah, for sure. Let's talk about a few of the things going on Canada, US, and other places. As always, we'll start with last week's quote of the week. Truth is like the sun. You can shut it out for a time, but it ain't going away. That was by Elvis Presley.
I didn't even know. Is that a song? It's a quote from him.
We got to figure that out. I have no idea. Thomas was, this is great. It's either Tracy writes this or Joan or Mark. It says Thomas was all shook up when he got it right. Well done, Thomas. So maybe it's from the song All Shook Up. I'm not sure. This week's quote, society is like a stew. If you don't keep it stirred up, you get a lot of scum on top. Ooh, that's a sizzler. I like that. If you know who that was by, if you know who that was by, then put it in the comments. No Googling. You guys know the rules. Don't fudge the process. That's a, you know, more timely quote than I think many people might realize. There's a lot of stuff rising to the top these days in society. Anyway, I don't want to get in trouble. So yeah, like I said, if you know the rules, put in the comments. You get your next renewal on EasyDNS, which is great. Can't beat that. Len, we got by my count here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Same. Stories. Two of them from sources I really like. One from TFTC, a Bitcoin show, and another from Law Bites, which is a podcast I listen to every week from Michael Geist. Where do you want to start this week's episode?
Let's talk about this FCC fining all these major carriers a hefty sum of money. That's because this is because there was a major blow to consumer privacy as these wireless carriers, U.S. wireless carriers, they were selling off information. So what happened? The FCC learned of this. They launched an investigation and uncovered that they're selling this sensitive information, such as the location data of consumers, to third-party services without the consent of the customers themselves. And we're talking about T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon, and a few others.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're selling this information, and this is very sensitive information, because when you're dealing with tracking somebody, they're where they're located, their movements, it's easy to build a profile on somebody. It's easy to figure out where they live, where they work, where they shop, what are their habits. Then it's easy to attack somebody.
Yeah.
And not just in this case where it's just targeted advertising, but there could be somebody that has malicious intents. And once they have this information, then it's easy then to, or much easier to launch an attack against an individual. So the fact that they're selling this information, like, that's pretty damning. Without consent, double damning. And it's the, what they're selling, man, it's just, it's trash all around. And the fact that they got fined heavily here, almost $200 million collectively, it goes to show you that this, there's some real seriousness here. Are they going to be giving the 1 year worth of credit protection or credit monitoring service? It, there's nothing that applies here. When it's when you're talking about your privacy to this level, who's going to give you some information to prove that, yeah, you're safe or you're not? Now these people, they're probably going to be looking over their shoulders, wondering who's out there to get them. It's one, you know, if you think about it, for somebody like us, you know, we're just a couple of guys, but you know, it's different if you're a gal out there in the world, because you never know who's around the corner and what they're going to be able to do for you and what yeah. they'll be able to do to you. So it's very scary stuff. If you ever pissed off somebody and then gets this information, well, you might be a target. So this is pretty crap, man, to see that these companies, these big companies, they're able just to sell off this information willy-nilly without you even saying, yeah, come on. And it's just too bad, because it's not like people can do anything about this. They can't just go to a competitor. Their competitor also sold off this information. It's not like you could turn off the service. Everybody needs a cell phone. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at this and it's just, I just shake my head. And this is just, it's too bad this is happening in 2024.
Isn't it crazy that this was only, the fines were only basically approved or granted by the FCC on a 3-2 vote? Like, you have these guys selling location data, like you mentioned, so much personal data gets sold. But location data is like, it's sacred in a way that advertising data might not be, or, you know, Netflix scraping the Facebook DMs, which we talked about a few years ago, might not be. Location data is where your nest is, you know, like you don't have anything if you don't have the privacy of where you live, where you sleep, where you work, where you know, like there's so many ways to grab somebody. In between these different locations that they frequent, dangerous doesn't begin to do it justice. And, you know, to your point, you know, you said that there was a huge fine levied on the providers. Was it really that big? $200 million across 3 or 4 providers here? Is that really that much money? I don't think that it is.
They'll raise service fees a couple of bucks for everybody.
You'll pay, exactly, right? Like that's kind of the worst case scenario. But even the more generous interpretation of events from a, you know, a keen market observer would be that $200 million for a company that has what is basically a monopoly on the service they provide, it's just not enough. It's not enough to deter. It's not enough to deter the behavior. And what I don't see in here is how much this data was sold for. There's some, you know, you kind of get some feel for what this data might be worth. But, you know, Len, we've talked so many times on this show over the last year about how much location data is worth on the open market to advertisers, to people who want to sell you a service or a product based on where you are at one moment when you're doing a Google search or something like that. The stuff is basically priceless. And $200 million doesn't, I don't think, you know, 196, I should say, doesn't begin to do justice to the crime here. The question I have for you, and I think the question that we all should be asking is, do you expect this practice to continue, number one? And do you expect the fines to reach a level that deters the behavior? I would say, yes, I expect it to continue. And no, I don't think the fines will reach level to deter the behavior, right? That's the story almost every time.
If they challenge the fine and if the...
They're all challenging it.
And if the decision takes long enough, that $196 million is easier to pay as the
delay.
Right? Make inflation work for you.
Right, yeah. They can just use Klarna and pay in four installments of $60 million or whatever the number is. You know, four installments of $50 million. Could be good. By that fourth installment, you're doing okay right after inflation. Yeah,
you could buy a car with that. Nice. Maybe. Let's move on to Kaiser Permanente. And that's one of the largest healthcare organizations in the United States. And we talk about this so often with these healthcare
providers. Every week is a healthcare story. I know.
Yeah. Well, another data breach that exposed patient information to third-party advertisers. And the breach occurred due to a certain online technologies that were implemented on Kaiser's websites and their mobile apps. And this transmitted user data without proper authorization. And so the amount of people that were impacted, 13.4 million people, they have since been notified, and an official statement was sent out just this month. And this is the data breach is the largest confirmed health related data breach in 2024 so far. So the year is still kind of young, so we could easily kill this record. And the company said that usernames, passwords, and social security numbers and payment information remains uncompromised. So if that information was not relayed to the people or they weren't able to steal it, this is actually a pretty good thing because, of course, that's pretty damning information. But what it is that they did take is unknown. I don't have that information. I tried looking for it. It's just unknown at this time. But the company also says that they apologized and they're taking steps to prevent this from happening again. Thank you very much. It just could have been the first time it didn't happen. But anyways, here's another one where we're going to provide 1 year worth of credit monitoring stuff. So hopefully these people, 13.4 million people aren't impacted too bad. But you know what? Like we talked about this every week. These healthcare places, they have so much information, so much sensitive information. They got to do a better job of preventing a data breach from taking place and having this information poached from them. But you know what? I suspect we'll talk about this again next, not this story, but a very similar one next week.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of healthcare providers in the States and all of them are basically getting pwned by black hats. The interesting thing here, I don't know. I mean, there's always some like discrepancy between the Google search results for certain search terms and the reality on the ground because there's time delays and whatnot. But let's just compare these two numbers, okay? It says that Kaiser's recent data breach affected, where's the number here? I think I saw it. 13.4 million affected current and former members. According to Google, and this is from the Kaiser about page, so maybe Kaiser isn't updated that often, they only have 12.5 million members right now. So that means that, you know, the total between current and former members compromised exceeds the number of current members today. So you had a 100% breach, basically, right? I mean, there's some gray area there, and you can measure these things different ways in terms of like, you know, current members, whatever. But that's a that's a major breach. And it's the biggest one of this year so far, just in terms of raw numbers as well. What are these people going to be given to ease the pain and burden that this caused? I mean, we joke about the 2-year thing all the time, but this is basically, this is like a huge failure. Kaiser Permanente, by the way, you know, big enough to sponsor some sports teams. They're a major player in U.S. healthcare, and I think a major player in U.S. healthcare research as well. So presumably they have the resources to prevent something like this, but have chosen to spend them other places, probably in executive bonuses or whatever else. But
what if they give the impacted people 1 year of opioids?
I mean, they might be able to do that. They're probably giving it to them anyway.
But they're paying for it. The customers are paying for it. They just give it to them like on that.
Well, I think, like I said on CBP on Monday night, you know, at age 35, all these healthcare providers will either give you opioids or Ozempic, and you know, you'll be a satisfied customer for, you know, some undefined period of time. But jokes aside, like, the thing that we talk about every week, and I'll say it again here for people who are listening for the first time, you must give your data to these people. You have no choice. You have to give them all your data, or they won't give you the service that will, you know, hopefully save your life when push comes to shove. And what do they do with the data? They, you know, to quote, to use a football term, right? They run through the line of scrimmage holding it like a loaf of bread. It's not going to work. You know, you're going to lose the ball and you're going to lose the data. And that's what we've seen here again. So I don't know, Len, how many more stories can we see like this? I got to count the number of healthcare providers, subtract the number of stories we've done, and that's the total.
Still a few thousand left to go. But
yeah, you know, every week it's another one.
We have this for a long time, but here's another good story. This webpage, GitLab, right? There's a critical vulnerability that was discovered in the email verification process, and this is being actively exploited in the wild. And the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, that's CISA or CISA, I don't even know how to pronounce it, but either way,
yeah,
this agency, they issued a warning about the critical vulnerability. And there is a common vulnerability scoring system. They gave it a 10 out of 10 on the CVSS. 10 out of 10, that's critical. 9 to 10 on this scale is critical. So that goes to show you how severe this type of vulnerability is. As of May 1st, 2024, so just yesterday, the looks like the 1,400 GitLab servers remain vulnerable despite these warnings. And this is according to data from Shadow Server Foundation. And the number reflects a decrease over the 5,300 vulnerable servers that were identified in late January 2024. So there is some efforts out there to go ahead and patch these servers, but still there's a number of them that unfortunately are still impacted. And there's an urgency out there for the organization of GitLab to apply the patch everywhere, and especially within federal government agencies that are bound by binding operational directive. And these agencies have been told they have until May 22nd, 2024 to identify and address any vulnerable GitLab instances within their network. So even the government is now pushing.
What do you mean even the government? It's always the government. It's not even the government. It's always the government who is getting dominated by these. Every week, Len, it's healthcare and government every week on this show.
They go hand in hand with getting owned. So yeah. Well, they're now forced to make some changes before 22nd of May to identify them and address all these vulnerabilities. So if you are a GitLab user, I'm not sure if you are, Joey, but anybody out there that is, and if you've signed up using the email verification process, I'm not sure, you might be impacted by this. So just take a look, take a gander, maybe create a new account and roll the dice that you are going to be using one of the patched servers rather than the unpatched servers. But yeah, that's all I got to say about this story.
I don't have a lot to add, but I want to talk about two things that are sort of adjacent to the story. One is GitLab is not the same as GitHub. So everyone thinks Git and they're like GitHub, tons of stuff on GitHub, including, you know, Bitcoin near and dear to us, obviously, among other things. Not the same thing. But maybe the more important thing, and I don't have the, you know, firepower, the technical expertise to talk about this, but this exploit is about the password reset process. Password reset processes for some of the biggest, you know, honeypots, corporations, in the world, have been the same, Len, for 20 years at this point, right? You give a reset email and or a reset phone number, and they send you a text with a code or send you an email to that other reset email, and they say, you know, go back to the password reset page, give the 5-digit code, and we'll reset your password. What I can't figure out is why we're still using this process. When I think about other things that I have to do, for example, if I send Bitcoin off of like an exchange, right? I have to give my authenticator password. If I log into my stock portfolio, I have to give my authenticator password. Why are we not using this for password reset yet? I don't know if it's just because we're kind of experiencing this technical deficit, a term that Mark Jeftovic turned me on to, you know, a little while back, that they're building on top of old systems and it's hard to implement these new measures in a way that's clean and efficient and easy to use for the average user. But in my view, we've really updated a lot of these other systems to prevent exploits from happening, but not this one. How is that possible? Doesn't that seem weird to you that password reset is still a vulnerability this day and age? It shouldn't be, right? Everyone's got passwords for everything. Why not move to the authenticator model for the reset mechanism? Maybe, I mean, there's probably some reason they haven't done it or some reason that's been difficult, but to me, it's inexcusable to not have this stuff lined up by now. I think anyway.
I'm old school. When I have to reset my password, I actually show up to the doors of that organization.
You go to the office. Mm-hmm. Nice. So nice.
Sometimes I have to take a Good. Plane to go there, but you know, that way I know for sure I'm not going to get hacked or compromised. Give me one of your terminals, people, and I'll be able to enter my new password. Password 123. All small cow. Anyway, let's talk about Apple.
Here we go. I'm going to be taking another chin here for sure.
I'm curious if it impacted you because there was a widespread Apple ID outage.
I have a lot to say about this. Give the story breakdown, and then I'm going to defend the mothership here a little bit.
Okay, I wasn't even going to attack it. I'm just curious what's exactly happened because this outage took place on April 26, 2024, and many Apple users were unexpectedly signed out of their Apple IDs, and this was across multiple devices, and they were forced to reset their password. We just talked about that, and this was in order to regain access to their accounts. And the outage appeared to take place or start around 8 p.m. Eastern, mm-hmm. and it quickly gained traction on social media as users were reporting this unexpected sign-outs. You know, you got to figure you have your phone or your iPad or whatever, so I know what the heck's going on here. So Apple's systems status webpage did not acknowledge that there were any system interruptions, which was odd. And this is even though that there was the sheer number of users out there reporting a significant issue. And some users were even noting that even after resetting the password, they encountered issues such as disabled iMessages and FaceTime functionalities, which required them to be re-enabled in the settings. And this is the one that I'm kind of concerned or curious about because the outage remains unknown and it's unclear as to whether there's any connection between the ongoing Apple ID password attacks that have plagued users for the past several weeks or whatever is going on, because there's not really much information coming from Apple. I checked today. They are tight-lipped on this, what happened. And essentially this whole thing just seems to be very odd. So yeah, go ahead. I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Okay, so Apple does a really good job with password protection and password resets, among other things. And what they've done is they've tied it to hardware devices. Now, in the story, let me actually take a step back before I go into this. So what happens when you have your iPhone or iMessage or Apple ID compromised? Not even compromised, but when there's an attempt to compromise it. Let's say a nefarious actor tries to get into your Apple ID. They have your email, but they don't have your password. They try 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, whatever. They can't get in. What Apple does is they say, okay, we see a problem here. There's a pattern where people are trying to get into this person's account. They don't seem to have the password. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take the liberty of forcing a password reset on our own, but we're not going to allow the password reset to occur via email in case they have the email, right? Assuming they have the password for the email that they're trying to get into. We're not going to allow the password reset to be done via SMS. That's not allowed either. We're going to use one of the devices on the account to do the password reset. So for me, I have an iPhone, I have a Mac, I have some other stuff in the house, I'm sure that, I, you know, has long since bit the dust, that are trusted devices on my Apple account. And so when something happens to me, or when someone tries to get into my account, I see a message on my iPhone that says, you have to reset your Apple password using this device. How do I know this? Because it happened to me 2 months ago. In the middle of the night, I woke up, you know, sleepless, whatever, take a leak, and went to reach for my phone and check the latest in doom and gloom on Twitter. And what do I see? I can't get into my phone. Even Face ID won't work. You have to reset your password using this device. It's a bit weird to see that in the middle of the night because you're not able to really process what's going on. You can't really put all these pieces together. But in retrospect, this is the best way to handle password reset. You have a couple of trusted devices on your account. One of them that's with you can reset the password. Now, even better, and the story makes this sound like a hassle, but even better, Apple also has stolen device protection as a setting in your phone. So not only do you need to have the device that's on your account, you have to be in a location that is familiar to the device. So your home, your job, the grocery store, your girlfriend's house, maybe if you're a little more fun than me, your mistress or drug dealer, and you know, you can reset the password if the familiar device is in a familiar location. That's pretty good. The question about the outage thing, I don't know. If I think back when it happened to me, I went to the Apple subreddit that morning just to see what was going on. And there was a lot of commentary that day about people who had had their devices ask them for this reset. To me, it sounds like there's probably a Grindr attack going on. I think we talked about this on the show before, that someone got a hold of a database full of emails and just assumed they all had Apple IDs, looked at some other databases with some common passwords, and were like, we can probably get into this iPhone. Let's try it. Enough people have iPhones that if one of those attacks is really wide-ranging and broad in nature, you will get enough traction on social media or Reddit that it looks like there's an outage or a problem with Apple services. My point of view, and you know, again, in defense of the mothership, would be that really Apple has done the right thing here, and they are the sort of last line of defense between you and you know, a hacking group or a hacker getting into your personal data. I think this is well done by them. I don't view this as an outage, and I don't think that it was an outage in any sort of traditional sense of that word. So kudos to Apple. I know you're not a huge fan of Apple, but I think you'll appreciate even the kind of the nature of that defense mechanism by the company. You're smirking, so maybe you don't appreciate it.
It's funny. You're so deep into this, you don't even see the problem that's associated with it.
Tell me what it is.
You owned a phone. Why do you have to ask Apple to give you access to it, even if somebody else is trying to compromise it? It's a centralized system.
But if someone tries to steal the phone, right?
It's gone. I don't care.
Thankfully, they actually don't. So one of the things that Apple actually does is if the phone is stolen, they basically, you know, you don't have to unlock the phone. The phone can only then be taken apart and sold for parts. Even then, you can't even use the parts because they're associated with the Apple ID that's with the phone. It's a pretty good system.
So let's go. I'm using an open source.
Yeah, you get the Pixel 7 there. Yeah, yeah.
It's encrypted. The data is encrypted. So if the phone is stolen, it's as good as the Apple phone. You have to take this, sell it for parts.
It's the same thing.
The difference is I'm relying on nobody when this. I'm not relying on somebody to, please let me in to use my phone.
But you don't have a Google Play account on that, right?
I know my password, and I don't.
But you don't have a Google Play account on that, right?
There is, but it's not contingent on me using it. The phone for me to get into it, I can able to. And even that Google Play account is within a walled system. It operates within a sandbox, and from that, I could allow whatever I want to be sent in and sent out.
But as far as compromising the account, like part of the thing that draws me to Apple is, you know, I pay for this service where if there's the potential that someone has compromised my account, which has my payment information, which has my address, which has all these things. I do want them to say to me, show me that you are who you are and use a device that you've put on the account in a location that you've told us is trusted. Otherwise, we're not letting you into the account because we think that you're compromised. I'm okay with that.
Why did you have to give up that information to begin with? Why did you have to give up payment information? Why did you have to give up your address?
Because I use my phone to pay for stuff. Like I have, you know, Apple Pay pays for stuff. I know this is where we find our dovetail, right?
So that's why if something happens to my phone where I'm not able to get access to it, I'm fine. I just spin up a new phone and away I go. Anybody that gets access to it, I think they're going to get my information. They're not. The thing is, it's locked pretty darn hard, and it's the data, and it is encrypted. So,
yeah,
right. Like, so the difference is, it's my device. I want access to it. I get access to it. You have to play within the rules that they say. If they open a door, then you'll get let in. If they shut
there's certain things I like about that.
I don't want to deal with a centralized service. I'd rather deal with something that's much more decentralized that gives me much more protection.
If this disagreement continues, I won't see you for another week if we keep talking about this.
Let's go to the last story, because this is one I know you've talked about.
Oh, for sure. I love Mike Geis is one of my favorite guys, man. He's so soft spoken, but he needs a bigger voice, honestly. Go ahead.
Well, you talked about this on the CBP. I forget which episode. Must have been.
It was like 3 weeks ago. The school boards in Ontario. I'll even do the recap for you. The school boards in Ontario launched a lawsuit against not all of them, but a few of them, including the Toronto
four school boards.
Yeah, including the Toronto District School Board, the largest in Ontario, launched a lawsuit against Meta, Snapchat, and TikTok for creating conditions in which their students were underachieving and were addicted to the apps and couldn't handle what they were being given as tools on their phones. And my opinion at the time was that the school board is led by unserious clowns who actually don't have any particularly bright insights on how to fix these problems and refuse to look in the mirror in terms of figuring out what caused them, and instead launch these very public lawsuits where only lawyers benefit. And like, you know, with many other school board wide initiatives, children come last and are often politicized. And this episode of Law Bites with Robert Diab does give a little bit of insight about how there is some precedent for apps being sued for things like, well, they, you know, infinite scrolling, for example, is an addictive feature in the app. And it's not that the app can't be addictive, but it has to disclose that it is addictive and has to, you know, tell its audience that there's potential for addictive behavior following, you know, usage of this app or while you're using this app. I understand these things. Don't get me wrong. But Diab, you know, ultimately is a lawyer and a professor of law in British Columbia and a friend of Michael Geist, who, again, I am a huge fan of. And so he views these things a certain way. This is a nail and he is a hammer in some regard. And he sees this as something that can be litigated. My point of view was and is that the teachers' unions and school boards have no one to blame but themselves for the poor performance of the kids. And parents have a responsibility here too. And they failed to adjust to an environment that is full of, you know, blinking stimuli at every turn. Teachers are addicted to these apps as well. And then, you know, they may not admit this. I would posit to you, Len, and I'd be curious to hear your stance, of course, because you have a young one in school. I think that what I've seen over the last few months, and especially over the last 2 or 3 weeks, is that the school board and the province have basically said, look, we realize this is a losing battle. And instead, what are we going to do? We're going to ban cell phones for some kids in Ontario schools. I think Minister Lecce last week or the week before, I wish I had the details sort of fresh on my mind here, but there's going to be rules about which kids can have cell phones in schools and why they can have cell phones in schools and for how long they can have cell phones on them in schools, because they are affecting classroom performance and ultimately affecting the quality of education that Ontario students are getting. this is the right answer. I said that on CBP and I'm saying it again now. The issue is cell phones in the classroom and the inability of teachers unions to stand up to parents who think that every kid, you know, all of a sudden needs a cell phone in case of an emergency, as if you and I didn't go through school knowing that if we had a problem, we would just go to the office to use the phone, right? Not everyone needs a phone if there's an emergency, just one person does.
There's a difference though, because we were born in, I'm not trying to defend it. We were born in a time where there was no cell phone, and kids now were not born in that time.
But like pragmatically from this argument, from the sort of, you know, the Big Bang theory in this argument is basically that every kid needs a phone because there might be an emergency. That's the origin point. That's not a legitimate argument in my view. It sounds like probably in your view either. You know, you don't need every kid on the playground to have a phone. You don't need every kid in the classroom to have a phone. The teacher can have one. Most classrooms, I think, have one at this point, or had one the last time I was in an elementary school classroom 10 or 12 years ago. And every school office has one. You know, every administrator office has one. There's phones on every floor of every school for different reasons. The problem is that the phones in the pockets of kids are distracting, not only for the kids who are on the phones, right? That's sort of causing a consequence forcing a consequence on those children for their own bad behavior, but they're distracting for kids who are trying to stay away from their phones, or whose parents have said, you can't bring your phone to the classroom, or who have the discipline to say, right now I can't have the phone out, I need to be learning. That to me is the bigger problem. And that's something the school board can solve and chose not to. They chose instead to put the blame on these, you know, app creators or app companies. I disagree with that. I think the blame is very clearly with the school board and with the teachers. And anything else is a deflection of responsibility, quite honestly, which is a trait that every teachers union in Canada has become very fond of, to be frank with you, over the last 10 or 20 years.
This is just society, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Right. This is.
They're not alone. No, they're not alone in this abdication of responsibility, but they're for sure doing it again here.
They're part of it, but yeah, you look at anything, it's all anything we do nowadays, it's always for that instant gratification, and it's anything that's going to be beyond 5 or 10 minutes worth of your time. It's just, unfortunately, that's the way people are now hardwired. I mean, I personally, before I could, I would love to sit down and read a book, but now I'm distracted from that. I just have so many other things. I'm not going to read a book the same way I would 20 years ago. And it's just because I've been groomed by society I'm always reaching for my phone like it's a nervous twitch to see what's going on.
Really?
Although there are times I put it away for hours at a time, but those are few and far between. It's when I'm doing something which I truly love to do. So what I'm trying to get at it, this is a societal problem. And until we try to address it, and this, the instant gratification garbage that we're always trying to achieve, and then our body releases endorphins and it's like, oh, this is wonderful stuff, right? Like, we got to get back to something that's more basic, but something that's just more, that's builds a society for a long term, not for that. I crap on TikTok all day long. It's absolute trash. Not the fact that it's run by the Chinese government, or associated with the Chinese government, but what is the length of a video on TikTok? What's the maximum length? I don't even know. I don't have
it. I've never had it on my phone. I never will.
Yeah. I'll guess 30 to 60 seconds. I don't know.
That's
pretty bad if you're just massaging people's minds to that is their maximum attention span. And anything beyond that, that's pretty sad. We're heading in the wrong direction. I'm not sure exactly how to address this. This whole lawsuit is probably not going to fix it, but it's just more than anything, it's shining a light that there is a problem that needs to be addressed. I'll give you anecdotal evidence here. There's a person that was in my daughter's class. She's now grade 5, so she's just turned 11. This kid, because he had, he wasn't all there. They allowed him to bring his Nintendo Switch to class, and he would play his Nintendo Switch in class. Bowser's Fury.
Lowest common denominator education policy, man. It's tough. It's tough. But
you know what I mean? Like that's really. But
the thing is, you know, it's one thing for the axe or the grinding wheel to kind of grind away at a kid who's got like, you know, mental shortcomings or like, you know, intellectual capacity issues that are genetic or birth related. Like those are unfortunate stories. They're difficult to deal with and they cause problems in classrooms for sure. But I'll tell you the other thing I see is that it's even, you know, that grinding wheel is even dulling some people who you would otherwise view as having, you know, a look into their own well-being on a longer time horizon at the gym. The number of people I see on their phone in between every set at the gym is staggering. And these
people,
are they
recording what they've done?
They're not recording. They're just like tweeting or texting or like they need the quick like scroll hit. It's unbelievable. And like those people, you know, I'm not saying they're, you know, the elite of the elite when it comes to, you know, being resilient to things like this, but certainly they're much more resilient to low time preference, or I should say high time preference behaviors than kids would be. But even they don't seem to be immune. These are people who presumably like, you know, meal prep and don't eat fast food and don't submit to the urges of the body when it comes to sugar cravings or anything like that, but still they're at the mercy of the phone during a, you know, a heavy lift. It's crazy the amount of inroads these devices have made in our lives and in our natures. And I think that the school boards, you know, for all the things they do wrong, this is an opportunity for them to really get something right that I think many people at a very, you know, primal level understand to be a problem. Even if they won't admit it to themselves, they don't want their kids to be subjected to it. I think that's safe to say.
You see what California is trying to do to fix this problem?
No.
They've recently tabled a bill that's going to make these social media companies change the way the content is delivered to the end user.
Like it's just
rather than having the algorithm dictate what gets sent to them,
it's going to be right. Done. And Diab, so in the Geist podcast that's sourced, Diab or Diab actually says the same thing, that there should be an option to go no algo when you're viewing the data or viewing the feed or whatever. But like, that's not reasonable. That's not a reasonable expectation because the apps just will not do it anyways. Like they're free to develop however they want. But number two, because kids don't, you know, they want the algo. That's what they're going to want. And, you know, at some point you're getting into this territory where like schools are telling you what your phone settings can be. Like, you don't want that. You don't want that. You know, you don't want your teachers being able to tell you what your phone settings can be, because once the wedge is in there, it's in there for everything. It's not just in there for TikTok. And that's anyway, a whole other story. But anyway, we'll wrap it up there. That was Access of Easy. If you enjoyed this program, Len and I talking to each other about all the problems with the school system, among other things, subscribe to the podcast, the YouTube channel, go to accessofeasy.com, read the newsletter. There's always more stories than we cover. Although we cover what we think are the most important ones, there's other stuff there for you to read and enjoy. And of course, the comment section is always lively as well. So head over there, do all that stuff. And until next time, take care of yourself.